Blog Talk Radio.
Don't tell me what I've got to think or say. That's none of your damn business anyway. Don't tell me now I need security. There's only one thing you can do for me. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. I'm not afraid of foreign enemies. They cannot take away my liberties. I'm not afraid of things that they might do. From what I see, I'm more afraid of you. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. Give me liberty. You hide behind the flag, but here's a fact. I see right through your phony patriot act. I think it's time you finally figured out what my America is. How it's all for my own good. I'd tell you where to shove that if I could. I'll say this just one time, so get it right. I won't give freedom up without a fight. And when we've got it, we've got everything.
Liberty.
That's right.
Give me liberty.
Give me liberty.
Give me liberty.
Don't tell me what I've got to think or say. That's none of your damn business anyway. For liberty, yeah, yeah. It's been our dream so long. The one thing that makes us strong. You know we can't go wrong. As long as we have liberty, yeah, yeah. It's like a beacon bright that shines through the darkest night. We'll make it home alright.
Give me liberty indeed, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about, one of the ways we can get liberty. That's Spartacus Jones from the Podcast Music Network, Give Me Liberty. We want to welcome everyone to a very special show for March of Liberty Radio. We're going to be talking about the Article 5 Convention with our special guest, Bill Walker, one of the co-founders of the Friends of the Article 5 Convention. and we'll be bringing him on here in just a minute. We just want to give a shout out and welcome to all our listeners out there. Also, we want to welcome those in the chat room already. If you're out there listening and not in chat, join on in. If you're wanting to call in to the show, you're more than welcome to do that as well. Area code 347-326-9311. And we want to just do a special shout-out and welcome to all of our friends over at the Hear My Thunder community, as well as give a shout-out and welcome to all of our listeners through our coalition partners from DownsizedDC.org and other areas. A couple of quick programming notes. This Wednesday morning on the Good Morning Liberty Show, we have a special guest, Digital Bob Nightingale. He's a longtime columnist, and he'll be a wonderful guest. So if you're up early, 8 a.m. Eastern Time, join us this Wednesday. Next Sunday, we have author Daryl Perry, 1776 and Today, Why We Need a New American Revolution is his book. So get ready for that and tell your friends. And then on the following Sunday, on the 24th, we have author Larry Bradley, a retired major from the Army who wrote Neither Liberal Nor Conservative Be. Very good book. And we'll have a special promotion for a giveaway on that. Let's see. I'm sure I'm forgetting someone out there, and I apologize if I do. I'm just excited to get this show started. This is, by the way, Gary Wood out of Salt Lake City, Utah, and of course my co-host,
Jason Wood, come out of sunny and hot, hot, hot Houston, Texas.
Hot, 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 huh?
Oh,
yeah,
hot.
See, we got stormy and cooler. See, the storms brought coolness, although they bring me some internet connectivity challenges. Anything that you can think I left off there, Jason, before we introduce Bill?
I think we're good to go.
Well, let's get this party started then, because, like I mentioned, Bill Walker is a co-founder of the Friends of the Article 5 Convention, former journalist and newspaper publisher. He was graduated from Washington State University with a bachelor in journalism, and he has bought two federal lawsuits, Walker versus the United States in 2000 and Walker versus the members of Congress in 2004, the last taken all the way into appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they dealt specifically with the obligation of Congress to call an Article 5 convention. So that's just a brief idea of the wonderful things. Bill, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Oh, any better? I just couldn't stand it.
Oh, that's good. How's the weather down there?
Well, we got thunder boomers and cracklings going on. No rain, though. So all we get is disruption from for the connections. But at least it keeps the temp down. How's the weather where you're at?
Well, it's kind of cloudy, and no rain here either. So it's, it's about 70 or so, kind of quiet.
Well, that doesn't sound like too bad of an August day.
No. It's better than having it rain, which in Seattle is not exactly an unusual event.
No, not at all. Not at all. I've got one of my sons in Portland and another up in Spokane, and I remember the Seattle area well for rain. So what is this Article 5 convention all about?
Well, the Constitution, as most people know, obviously, can be amended. That is, you can change particular parts of the Constitution through a formal process.
Right.
And the Constitution has its procedure, which was created and has never been amended, at the original 1787 convention. Now, that 1787 convention was, of course, authorized under the original national government structure, which is known as the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
And that was put in place by the vote of the states after they were granted independence from England approximately 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. So from about 1783 through when the Constitution took over, we were under a different structure of national government. Well, To make a long story very short, due to the fact that at least one state, Rhode Island, which was commented by everybody, just wouldn't go along with everything, and that the Articles of Confederation basically said that everything had to be unanimous, everybody had to agree, nothing got done. They just totally could not run a national government.
Right.
So in 1787, the Congress of that confederation called for a convention.
Right.
Out of that came the proposed Constitution of the United States, which
right.
was made up of different parts of where the founders had thought that they needed to make changes, plus the original language of the Articles of Confederation. It was a conglomeration.
Mm-hmm.
In that was what they called Article 5. And Article 5, just to read it, is the part that deals with the Amendment Convention. And what it says is, the pertinent part of it is, the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by Congress. They liked writing long sentences in those days.
Yes, they did.
Well, summing it up, basically the founders, and they expressed this in writings such as Federalist 85 by Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
were worried
right.
that they'd just gotten over war with the king. Okay, they did not want to have all the power in one political body.
Right.
And so what they did was they looked at all of the ways to split up this power. And this is known in legal circles as the separation of powers doctrine.
Right.
Well, they did the same thing in the mandatory process. And they said, okay, we're going to make this so that you can propose this one of two ways. First, you all can take it to Congress, which everybody knows about. Or Congress, if the state legislatures want one and enough numbers apply, they have to call an Article 5 convention.
Right.
Now, Hamilton wrote about it, like I said, in Federalist 85, and he described
right.
it as peremptory, which is a legal term, which is the same used in those days as it means today. It means, you, in simple language, you got to do it. There's no options, period. It is obligatory, mandatory.
Right. Peremptory, that's it.
It's the end of the deal. Right. And
On the Articles of Confederation, you know, there was a lot of people in the convention that felt the Anti-Federalists, a lot of them felt that the Articles didn't need to be replaced, just tweaked. But in the total debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and throughout that, I don't remember anyone in the Anti-Federalists against Article 5. They were always in support of that as well, right?
No, it's one of the amazing things about an Article 5. You
mm-hmm.
can't find anybody who doesn't say they disagreed as to whether they could get enough states to apply, is the thing they
right.
argued over. What they didn't argue over was its meaning and intent. They all agreed it was peremptory, and they all agreed that it was a simple numeric count of states, two-thirds of the applying state legislatures.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Anti-Federalists, there's Anti-Federalist papers where the guy that wrote it said, yeah, it's a numeric count. Everybody agreed as to the meaning. And
right.
so there wasn't any debate over it. And, in fact, if you study it as far as the history of the proposal, the original language that was proposed by the delegates was even more explicit than what is in the actual final draft. It was less flowery, and it just basically said, you've got to call a convention on a two-thirds application of the states,
mm-hmm.
period. That's how it started out. And it stayed that way throughout the entire process. There was about, six or seven different versions, words being moved around and so on and so forth. But it always was a two-thirds numeric count.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I think people need to realize up front is back when all the debates over all the things that were going on, whether we should even have a separate constitution or whether we should just stay with the Articles of Confederation and fix them. And, you know, the bantering back and forth, Article 5 was supported on all sides as
right.
a means
of, as to meaning.
As a,
correct.
Yeah. So this yeah. isn't something that any of the founders thought was a bad thing. This was how. Now, some people get this confused, I've noticed, with the idea that this is what creates a living document out of the Constitution. Which is
no,
not.
No, I would say no. And the reason
right.
is because the Article 5 convention is part of the amendment process.
That's right.
If there is living document, and the way that it's used typically is what you hear, it's everybody says, well, you know, we'll just look at the language and we find whatever we want in it and we just go from that point on.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And you can cite 100 different examples of it. Everybody's familiar with them. I'm not going to waste the airtime on that.
But the Constitution isn't a living document, but Article 5 gives us a way to amend it.
Keeping it a living document. Right. Technically, Article 5 was intended to make it the living document. That was what the founders gave us. The problem is that getting an amendment in the Constitution is not and should not be an easy process. I mean, first, you've got to get two-thirds of the group, Congress, or a convention delegate, to agree to even propose it. Now, that's not exactly easy. Then, after you get that taken care of, then you got to go out to the states. And you got to get three-quarters of them in one fashion or another, either through conventions at the state level in ratification votes or at the state legislatures, to agree with it. So basically you're looking at about 75% of the nation is going to have to agree with it, and only about 25% of the nation has to disagree to stop it. Essentially, we have an amendment process that's designed to be vetoed by the minority.
Right. And that was all part of the whole idea of us not being a pure democracy or a representative democracy, that the rights of the minority would still be protected from the tyrannical nature of a majority.
Right, exactly. And that way, if you had, for example, the original 13 states, just to put it in perspective people would understand as far as doing math, if four states disagreed with an proposed amendment, they could stop it. That's all it would take. So it's a relatively small number even today. It'd be 14 states today. That's all it would take. It's just they won't know or don't even take it up. And if they just did nothing and there's not enough three-quarters, it's done.
Right, right. Now, so it was basically put in there as a tool to improve the Constitution as we got smarter, I'm guessing, as well as giving the people an opportunity to have control over a lot of the supreme law of the land, right?
Right. Because the founders were afraid, and this was in the debate and was discussed, they were afraid that if they only made it Congress, and as Hamilton said in Federalist 85, in today's English, basically if the politicians have their way, they'll hang on to any power they've got, and we don't want that. I mean, he said a lot more eloquently than I just did, but that's basically what he was saying.
Right. Right. Yeah.
This was another concern.
Pardon?
I was going to say this is another check and balance that was put in place. So if Congress wasn't willing to do what needed to be done, or if Congress and the executive branch and the judicial branch were all kind of in cahoots together and not acting as they were supposed to, that then the states could come in as another check and balance and make things happen as what it was supposed to be, right?
Exactly. That is what it's supposed to be. And like I said, it hasn't been amended, so that supposed to be is still the exact way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the federal judiciary can regulate, or the bureaucracy, or any part of the federal government, or even technically you could pass an amendment to ratify to actually regulate the states themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Or grant the people more rights and things like that. Whatever the people felt they needed to keep their government responsive to their needs. It all goes back to the Declaration of Independence, to the key phrase, the center of the whole Declaration of Independence, the right of the people to alter or to abolish their form of government.
Mm-hmm.
This was the mechanism that the founders gave to the people to be able to carry out that right, that most fundamental right.
Yeah, and it is a fundamental right that most people today are not aware of.
No.
I talk to so many people, and they're not aware that we have the powers. You know, most of them aren't aware of the four boxes we have, you know, the soap box, the ballot box, the juror box, and the cartridge box.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of them think the cartridge box. But they don't realize this key and critical aspect, this Article 5, and the power it is.
No, they don't. They've never basically dealt with an Article 5. I have for 20 years and found out the power of it by just myself. And I can tell you that is an experience that once you've experienced it, there's no way you're not going to support an Article 5. I mean, let me give you just one example. You already mentioned my lawsuit. So let me give you an example of just how much power an Article 5 convention can convey.
Okay.
I'm a guy that lives up in the Northwest. Okay, mm-hmm. I am not a famous lawyer. I'm not well known anywhere, such and so. I wrote a letter to the Supreme Court after Walker v. United States, and I sent it to the justices. Now, I would be willing to bet that if they don't get at least 1,000 letters a day from people that are writing them for various things, in just not legal petitions, but everything else, mm-hmm. I'd be surprised. And it's probably much higher. I got a brief response to my letter, which I put in the lawsuit, from a guy named Guria, who was the legal representative, the lawyer, of the Supreme Court, the actual justices. Now, 6 months later, this is 6 months later, so all these letters and everything has been gone. You're talking probably 50, 60,000 people have probably gone across to Mr. Guria's desk and so on and so forth. I make a phone call to Mr. Guria. I said my name. That's it. And he knew exactly who I was.
Hello.
Yes.
Now,
why do you suppose
that flagged so high?
Well, it's the same reason as when I went in with my first lawsuit, that I got the U.S. attorney for the district and I got the presiding chief justice of the district mm-hmm. court. It's why when I say my name in Congress to any member of Congress, not even my own constituency, they knew who I was. It's
mm-hmm.
that reason, because what I'm representing. I am representing the sovereign American power that they know if the American people figure it out, they are in deep trouble. Because
yeah.
it's cool to mention it, to ask a member of Congress. In fact, I got a letter here. Let me switch it over and let me just read this letter of one of our members that
okay.
just wrote this. He said, Bill, I have openly confronted several Congress members in public arenas now directly. This is talking about Article 5. This campaign season is open season on them. They all respond with thundering silence, completely dumbfounded. One chased me after the showbiz, meaning his public speech this guy gave, to ask
right.
about it. They don't have a clue what the Constitution says. It's not just that they won't address the issue. Neither the members nor their staff have a clue. I am really glad that 225 years ago, they wrote the word peremptory into the Constitution, which
mm-hmm.
is the word shall call. So it's more important than ever that all the applications from the Congressional Record are compiled into a public condemnium readily available for anyone who wants to look. I gave my last victim, Representative, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Ciro Rodriguez, I believe he's in Texas, the
mm-hmm.
FOAVC.org site to refer to for the applications. He kept wanting to know the date that Texas sent its applications to Congress. I hope the information is there for him, which it is. We have them all
mm-hmm.
now listed. He was almost catatonic when I hit him with the Article 5 question after having ranted and raved for 2 hours on every imaginable topic under the sun. And I would say catatonic is just about the right word to use. Yeah, that's been my experience. If you want to have something really cool, I don't care what your position on Article 5 is, but if you want to have something really cool to do to your members of Congress and you really want to feel the power, just go up and ask them what's your position on Article 5.
Ooh.
And just watch the look on their face. I mean, it gives you a sense of power and gets you to remember that the people of this country are sovereign American citizens, because they're going to run scared. I guarantee it. There's never one of them now. They are, since Walker v. members of Congress, they run scared. And I'm sure we'll get into why, but there's reasons for it. They run scared. And it isn't often that you watch a member of Congress who loves to be able to expound and talk about anything run from an issue. Literally run.
Yeah, that's great. I love it when they have any kind of chink in the armor where they realize, doggone it, right now these people still do control us.
Well,
we're working on that, but right now they still control us.
See, now that's the thing. After the election, everybody assumes it's all over. Article 5 convention can be held at any time.
Yeah. Now, what is an application involved? What is an application for an article?
Well,
the application
is an actual formal act by the state legislatures. It is voted on by both houses of a state legislature, except in the case of Nebraska where there's a single house.
Mm-hmm.
But it has also traditionally been signed by the governor and certified by the Secretary of State of that particular state. This is a formal action by the state. This is not like somebody scribbles it down on a pad and sends it in to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It is then sent to Congress formally and also usually to the members of the other states, the other state legislatures, and to the members of Congress, at least to the delegation of that state.
Okay.
The pattern has been for Congress to basically take all of these in and then do nothing.
And there's been a few of them, right? How many of these applications have we had that you've been able to find so far?
Well, if the records are all accurate,
mm-hmm.
We're up to about 636, or about 12 average per state. Per state,
yeah.
And they've been filed primarily, not all, but primarily in the 20th century, about a little over 600 of them.
And how many Article 5 conventions have we had from that?
Zero.
Oh,
they require
and how many applications does it take to make a Article 5 convention happen?
34.
And
are you getting it, folks?
There's over 600, and we haven't had one.
Right. And it's a mandatory constitutional requirement, part of the Constitution. This is not – some people come up and say, well, it's a great idea. Hey, it's not an idea. It's the law.
The Constitution still the supreme law of the land? We haven't changed that, right?
Yes. And it's the same logic as saying, well, it's a great idea that we have an election to get rid of George Bush. Now, I'm not going to go into the details or debate on that issue, but the point is, it's not an idea. There's an election. It's required, you know? I mean,
right.
You know, same logic as somebody saying that, I mean, or any other part of the Constitution.
How are they able to get away with not obeying the Constitution, not obeying their duty here? How has this been allowed to go on? Because obviously this has gone on not just for a couple of years. This has gone on for well over 100 years.
Yeah, well, basically, and I do not know all the details as to why,
mm-hmm.
until I filed my lawsuits, nobody really called them on the issue. The states, and we have over 400 of the texts now on our website, foabc.org. We already have that many up. People can read. We're getting more of them. It's literally the volume of getting them up that's slowing things down. I mean, when you're dealing with 600 pages of congressional record and, you know, add on another probably 50 or 60 pages on that, copying them down just takes time.
Sure,
but we now have over 400 of them. The states have called them at least four to six times, depending on which way you want to read it, where they basically said, look, the states have applied, where's our convention?
Mm-hmm.
And response of Congress has been total silence. They just ignored it.
Why are the states remaining quiet on this?
Oh, there's any number of reasons. It could be that the federal government may have gone in and basically said, we'll cut off your revenues. I mean, who knows?
I think a lot of that stems
from the
14th and 16th Amendment and just the wrong flow of our whole process.
Right.
The states have powers.
Right. There could be any number of reasons, but I don't think that you could say they don't know they have the power. Because if you read the text, right, if you read the text from the actual state legislatures, they know they got the power. They've made that perfectly clear. There's no way that anyone can read those texts and not understand that the states know precisely what the power is. But the problem is that what Congress has done is they've done nothing. They simply put them in as what they call a memorial. Now, the interesting thing about this is to show you that it is a deliberate decision on Congress, that this isn't some clerical oversight.
Okay.
All of the ratification votes for all the proposed amendments, as far back as we can trace the record, which goes back to at least the 16th Amendment and probably earlier, are also submitted by the states as memorials and suffered the same exact process. In other words, we've even got applications where you can read a ratification vote and an application on the exact same page of the congressional record.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they send it to the committee of the judiciary. The committee then takes the ratification vote adds it up and goes on with it from that point, and then just ignores the application for the convention and does nothing. They haven't compiled them. They haven't done anything.
So who is the one specific person, is there for one, but who is the one specific person that is responsible in Congress to acknowledging these and making it happen? Who is there one specific person right now that is holding an office that is completely dropping the ball?
That would be the leaders of the Senate and the House. That would be the Honorable Dick Cheney and Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House.
Right.
Directly responsible. Pelosi.
Pelosi would be directly responsible as Speaker of the House for seeing that the Congress obeys the rules.
Do you know when? Cheney. What's the most recent application date, Bill?
Okay, the most recent one that we know of that's being discussed is right now down in the state of South Carolina. They are debating an immigration proposal today.
Okay.
I mean, in this time frame, it started back. 2007, I believe the gentleman is the Speaker of the House, if memory serves. I might be incorrect on his title, but he's brought this to the South Carolina legislature, and they are in the process, I understand, of proposing it. So this process has gone on and continues.
Right.
Let me
ask this real quick, Jason, then I'll let you in. You say it's gone. That reminds me of hearing that. What's meant when they say the convention is the only road-tested part of the Constitution?
Well, when the founders wrote the Constitution, they put in a lot of new sections and stuff that had not been tried before. For example, they created a federal judiciary. The president was something that was new, in a national president, so on and so forth. If you read the Federalist Papers, you'll see a lot of them are written in the future tense, that this will occur, or we think that this is going to happen, or this will be the effect, or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
When they talked about the Article 5 convention, they were talking about the convention that they themselves were at right then. So even though this wasn't an Article 5 convention, the 1787 was approved under the Articles of Confederation. But they were looking, they were at it right there. They had the idea what the convention would do, how it would propose amendments, so on and so forth. They'd also had similar conventions in all of the states, making up their own constitutions and so on and so forth. They'd had conventions all over the place. It was a very common way in the 1800s of conducting political business. So it was road tested. They had faith in the convention.
They understood. Yeah, they understood.
Wasn't
a pie in the sky theory.
Right. It was road tested.
The proof is that we actually have a constitution, which came out of that convention.
That convention method. Yeah. If the founders are our fathers. Yeah, the founders are considered our fathers. The convention is the mother of our country.
Right.
Yeah. So now, you know, we point the finger and say Congress is dropping the ball here, but the reality of the matter is the states are dropping the ball here as well. They're not speaking up. They're not going to the people and saying, hey, you know, they're not on TV all the time saying, hey, we keep on sending these applications. When are you, the people, going to stand up and help us? They're just being quiet. They're just quietly sending applications and not griping at all that they're being ignored. So the buck's not just stopping at Congress. It's stopping with the states as well.
That's true. There hasn't been, because there has been movements where, for example, in the 1990s, early 80s, balanced budget was going to be a convention, and opponents to that, those amendments, rather than fight the amendment proposal, which was for balanced budget in this case, spread a lot of lies about a convention, and a lot of myths got raised about a convention, none of which basically were true. And so a lot of people have gotten cold on the idea of a convention because they believe these myths, yet when you research them, they're proven to be completely false.
Wow.
This stuff just baffles me because, you know, I'd never really heard about this before I ran across your information. And, you know, I mean, I know that Congress isn't upholding their oath of office already and dropping the ball on it, just about anything that we really need. But, I mean, this is just amazing to me. And it's even more amazing to me that the states aren't speaking up and griping, and I mean, this has gone on for, you know, well over 100 years, and I mean, people just don't know about this.
No.
That's crazy.
No,
that's part of what we're here.
Well, yeah. it gets even worse than dropping the ball when you get into the Walker's lawsuits. It goes well beyond that.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get into that. But, yeah,
I'm curious. Now, we should be asking our states if they have applications. Why didn't you ever follow up on it, I imagine? But what should we be asking our members of Congress about an Article 5 convention, besides what do you know about it and make them nervous? Is there anything specifically you think we should ask?
Yeah, I've got a question that I've sent out to people to ask, and I'll just read it.
Okay.
It deals with the lawsuits. It says, in 2006, you joined a federal lawsuit. You address this to your member of Congress, your current member of Congress or senator. You joined a federal lawsuit to declare you and all the members of Congress had the right to veto the law of the Constitution under the political question doctrine. The suit was Walker v. Members of Congress, which dealt with the peremptory obligation of Congress to call an Article 5 convention. There are over 600 applications on file from all 50 states. Only 34 applications from 34 states are required in order to have Congress issue a call. The actual text of these applications are now available for public viewing at the website, and our website, www.foabc.org.
Mm-hmm.
Your attorney of record, the Solicitor General of the United States, stated at the Supreme Court that the required call is based solely on a numeric count of states. He also stated that by you even joining this federal lawsuit and asserting in a public lawsuit you have the right to veto the Constitution, that you violated federal criminal law, specifically your oath of office. Would you care to comment on why you feel you have the right to veto the Constitution, if you plan on vetoing other sections of the Constitution, and why you chose to commit a criminal act? And finally, has your position changed on your opposition to an Article 5 convention?
Ooh. Now that is a great... And that's a letter or an email that you've sent off to your representatives.
Well, I asked my own, and I actually couldn't get even the public schedule of when I could ask this of mine. So I finally got a hold of his opponent and called them up and got a stunned silence from them. And they're not even part of the lawsuit, so they're in the clear. I mean, they're totally clean, and they're studying it right now. And I'm hoping that basically I can get their reaction to find out if they think that the member of Congress should be a should be able to commit criminal acts.
Yeah. Anyone listening out there that wants to ask, if you have a congressman that was in the House in 2000 or the Senate in 2006, because it was both houses that joined this, right?
Right. Unanimous.
So if you guys have a member of Congress that was in there in 2006, we'll post this text that Bill's read to us over at hearmythunder.org in our forums section, and you can copy and paste it and send it in and let us know what kind of reactions you get. What I love about this, Bill, is specifically your oath of office, because that's one of my major challenges with all these people. They take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not their party, not their personal beliefs, not anything but the Constitution, and they violate
it. And it gets even better. Now, let me finish up on the federal laws that are involved in this, because I think people will be very interested in reading this. Because they said that I had no standing, federal law kicked in on regarding this because it's the Constitution. You have to obey federal law. So if they're going to say they don't have to, they had to create what is called a 530D report. It's required by a section of law that we got in our lawsuit, in our site that you can read. It's just for anybody's reference. All of this is documented in our FAQ section under 9.1 is the question. There's a lot of links, and I'm not going to go into a lot of law situation, but it's there. Anyway, this 530D report, they had to send that to Congress, the Department of Justice, before they made the decision to vote to do this. They're required to make a decision, to request that this was made. This was not something that could simply be, oh, well, you know, my clerk handled this. No. The federal law specifically requires that they had to decide. So in other words, what I'm saying is that all three major candidates for the presidency of the United States, the United States senators, Obama, McCain, and Clinton, all three of them joined this lawsuit. They all three regardless of who we elect, when they take that oath of office in 2009, when that person, whoever it's going to be, steps mm-hmm. up, they're going to be committing an act of perjury because they are on public record as not believing that they have to support the Constitution.
Yeah.
And it
They've
doesn't
already...
matter if you're talking Obama or Gain or whatever.
Yeah.
So who's responsible for prosecuting these people?
That would be the Department of Justice.
Our good old friend Mukasey, right?
Well, it was actually this thing goes states back all the 2000, so it was actually it was Janet Reno.
Solis was in there and Reno and
mm-hmm, at that point, and then they carried this forward as an argument into Walker v. Members of Congress. But yeah, both the Bush administration and the Clinton administration were involved in this.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of Henry Kissinger, though. He said, you know, the illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes us a little while longer. So
yeah. But what I find is amazing is that, you know, you always hear about this thing about people talk about they want bipartisanship. This is 100% bipartisanship. I mean, there was nobody that said, no, I believe in banning the Constitution. I want to have an Article 5 convention. Not one single person.
Even Ron Paul's in on that, huh?
Oh, yeah. 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 They all, every single member of Congress, you see, Walker v. Members of Congress, the reason it's called that is because I sued every member of Congress individually. It was not a group. Every one of them was served.
Wow.
So they had to make...
Why do you think they're so unanimous on this?
Because they're scared of what the effect of it can... I mean, take a look at some of the subjects.
They're trying to hold on to their power.
Well, look at the subjects that would be described. You're talking about congressional term limits. You're talking about balanced budget. You're talking about complete review of Supreme Court decisions. These are things that the states have talked about and have proposed. You're talking about an initiative referendum recall system. You're talking about a direct election of the President of the United States by popular vote. That's just a few of them. I mean,
yeah, there's good and bad in there.
Right, there's good and bad. But the point is that the reason that it should be is it should not be a bunch of politicians who just decide they're going to veto the Constitution. These issues, and the convention is completely issue. There wouldn't be a re-election of these delegates. Once the convention's proposed, it's over. They're done. That's job's finished.
And the delegates come from where again? I'm sorry?
The delegates would be elected from the different states. They would have a group of delegates that the states would elect. The Supreme Court has already said that. They have to be elected.
And these delegates actually have to be elected by the people. Right,
mm-hmm.
They can't just be appointed to an office. They had to have actually been elected by the people.
No, the Supreme Court back in the 1920s said that these have to be elected people. They can't appoint them. And the point is that the delegates would have to debate these issues when they're campaigning. So you know what position they're going to take because you've got the text there. You know what other subjects would be described. I mean, obviously, you know, it's not going to be a state secret. People are going to be trying to talk about issues that aren't already on the books. They're going to be asking the delegates. So they're going to have to answer about these issues. So, you know, you're pretty much going to have, as it were, the people electing the delegates for the positions that they take on those particular amendment proposals. And remember, it's 2/3.
Right.
So it's big. It's not like you're going to be able to get in there and get 6 guys elected and slip something by.
And slip something through, sure. And then even if it gets through the 2/3, 3/4 of the states still have to ratify it. So,
I mean,
there's a lot of stop gates. Now, what is your estimate, just out of curiosity on that, what's your estimate that for something to start as an application for a convention to actually reach fruition to an alteration in the Constitution, what would you consider a time frame?
If the average ratification, I read somewhere, is anywhere from 3 to as long as 8 or 9 years.
To get it ratified once it's
on.
From the time
it was written in Congress.
Right.
But to give you an idea of how hard that is, according to records that I've read in Congress, and I'm sure they'd be the same basic thing in a convention, probably less than the first one. If they had another one, there'd probably be more. But the total number of applications or ideas of congressmen and so on and so forth for different amendments is about 10,000. We've had 27.
Yeah, it's like way, way, way less than 1% ever makes it.
Correct.
Ever
yeah, it's tiny. You
and
really
it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
two of the original amendments didn't make it. I mean, there was originally 12 amendments. Only 10
technically,
the
actually,
right.
Well, actually, one of the original amendments didn't make it. The
oh, okay.
27th
yeah,
Amendment is one of the original 12 amendments that were proposed.
That's true. Yeah, I forgot that. It came back around. I know on the, and this was congressionally ran through, wasn't Article 5. It took from, for the 16th Amendment, it took them from the time the Supreme Court said income tax is unconstitutional, it took 16 years to reach ratification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took about 12 years to get the amendment, the 16th Amendment, through Congress, and then another close to 4 years or 3.5 years to get it. So it's not an easy process. It's not something that you can just play with and control with. Now, on you mentioned a lot of different issues and things that could be brought up.
Right.
Would you suggest a single focused convention or a convention that carried such a wide array of issues?
Well, because Congress has completely ignored the ball, okay,
mm-hmm.
completely ignored this issue, the first convention is going to be what people will probably come to call a quote-unquote general convention. You simply
okay.
have got so many subjects and issues, or issues is the best way to use it, because technically all of the applications are one subject for a convention call. That's what their purpose, their subject is. They then
okay.
present an issue. You're going to have about 17 or 18 issues at least that are going to have to be discussed, because they're on the agenda. They're sitting there. You can't just, as the convention, say, well, we're only going to discuss one issue. They can propose amendments. But the practical politics dictates that after a first convention, it would be basically a single-issue situation. Let's just take an example. Let's say that issue X that people want to do, they want to change, just throw something out, people don't understand. Say they wanted to get rid of the judiciary. This goes
okay.
completely wild and it would never happen, but let's just use
sure.
that as an example. They want to do that. Okay, they get a big, huge political movement. The states get in there, they put their applications in, and bambo, you've got yourself your two-thirds request. Okay, fine. The chances politically that anything else would therefore be considered are pretty remote, because this thing is its high water mark and would hit, and then it would be discussed and disposed of. But the chances of that kind of a radical amendment happening are almost zero, because the states, even if they were somehow bamboozled into that kind of change, would not ratify it. You just are not going to get that radical change. The rule of thumb that amendments seem to follow is this: the more radical the proposal, the less chance it has.
Hmm. Okay. So you want to state some issues that people can get their arms around and embrace.
And I would imagine a lot of times it would be issues that are very common that are already out in the public arena and have been discussed a lot, and that there's already a big movement of people behind, but the government has been ignoring them, and that would be something that would tend to be more successful if
right.
the public arena was already well aware of it and the government was just ignoring them.
Well, let's take the pocketbook issues, for example. There's two big
okay.
ones there. Let's take the fact that if the Constitution had been obeyed by Congress, nobody probably listening to this broadcast would be paying income tax. They've all been paying federal income tax their whole life that they didn't legally have to repay.
Right.
Just that
yeah.
simple. So you're talking that most people would be about a third to 50% richer than they are,
mm-hmm.
overall income. Balanced budget, huge issue. Again, more than enough to ratify the amendment, not just propose it, but from the states to ratify it.
Yeah, that one might
here
go through in record time.
And here we are in perpetual debt.
Right, and again, a balanced budget amendment could have made that situation much better than it was. And again, we at FOABC, we're a nonpartisan organization. We don't advocate any particular amendment proposal, but we do use them as examples, and those happen to be some of the highest numeric counts that there is. There's a lot of other issues that are a lot lower, but those, you know, are overwhelmingly supported by the states.
So now what's going on right now to try to get Congress to actually uphold their duty? I mean, is there anything that you know, we can get behind? Is there anything actually happening that could possibly force these people to do this? Or
sure. Ask them the questions. like we posed there, or questions like it. How come there's no Article 5 convention? Make it a public issue. It is part of the Constitution. It's as valid as any other part. How come they're not banned?
Yeah, and it's not a hazy area. I mean, the more I've read about it, it's like there's no haze here. This is clear cut.
See, when I wrote
sounds like
my
a good town hall question.
Right. Well, when I wrote my original Walker, when I wrote my original Walker United States brief in 2000, I wrote an original brief of some 800 pages. I used over 200 Supreme Court rulings to back up my positions. There's no haze in the law.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, it's as solid as a piece of concrete. Because, you see, the thing is, the election laws that you would elect a member of Congress would be the same laws that would apply to electing a delegate. The delegate would be a federal official. Therefore, his conduct, like, for example, accepting bribes, having to take an oath of office, etc., would apply. So all of the laws are in place. They're just, you're just simply substituting a different party, meaning a person and his particular office, for what you commonly do. But the procedures are well understood by everybody.
Hmm. Now, you know, you talk about the procedures being well understood by everyone, of course, outside of the general population. Aren't there some, basically some, what are some of the myths or falsehoods about an Article 5 convention? And really, where have those come from?
Well, the primary motivator, I guess you would call it, behind the myths is the John Birch Society.
Really?
Yeah, they are what you would call the big honchos in spreading the myths. They have spread myths such as, for example, that the original Constitution or the original 1787 convention was a runaway, and therefore if we have a convention today, it's going to run away and it's going to take over our rights. It's going to write a new constitution and they can do whatever they want for it. Now let me just quote a letter that was sent by John F. McManus, president of the John Birch Society.
Okay.
He wrote this to another of our co-founders, Joel Hirshhorn, February 3rd of last year.
Okay.
There has only been one such convention in our nation's history. He's referring to the 1787 convention. And that is an incorrect statement. As I indicated,
right,
that's by the Articles of Confederation. There's never been an Article 5 convention. But anyway, he continues, "It occurred when delegates of the states were gathered together and given the assignment of revising, quote, repairing the Articles of Confederation. That was the only task they were supposed to accomplish. But they acted as will any constitutional convention. With full authority that is possessed by any such gathering, they discarded the Articles and produced an entirely new governmental system, the Constitution. Their meeting became a, quote, runaway, unquote, convention. We might applaud what they gave us, but we must realize that they had no restraints. With this precedent in mind, thoughtful Americans for 220 years have chosen never to open up any opportunity for such a development again. As for the needed ratification of any convention's decisions by the states following an Article 5 convention, be aware that what is stipulated in the Constitution's Article 5 regarding this could also be altered or abolished by the convention. Everything in the current Constitution could be tossed, and whatever the conventioners would decide would replace it. A new convention could even decide not to bother having the states ratify what it produces. A constitutional convention has no limits." Well,
I'm sorry. Am I missing something when you read the text of the Article 5? That doesn't sound like they can just run away.
No, and let me just read the actual call by the 1787 Congress, February 21st, 1787, the actual words they used to call this supposed runaway Constitution convention that they're talking about. "Whereas there is provision in the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union for making alterations therein by the assent of a Congress of the United States and of the legislatures of the several states, resolved that in the opinion of Congress it is expedient that on the second Monday in May next, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states be held in Philadelphia." Remember that the Articles of Confederation were different than the Constitution.
Right.
There was no Supreme Court ruling, so they appointed them. "For the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. They were instructed to render a federal constitution and send their recommendations to Congress and then to the states. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah,
they sent
the
it to Congress.
Difference, yeah, the
they
only
voted
difference,
and it went to the states.
It went to the states. The only difference I see in his argument is rather than just simply attempting to repair the Articles of Confederation, they felt it was better just to restructure an entirely new document.
And that is because the Articles of Confederation were written different than the Constitution.
Right.
The technical
right.
point of this is this. The Constitution, Article 5, allows for amendments to this Constitution. Okay? Meaning, in other words, you can't get rid of the original. You have to amend and add to something. An amendment has to be something to the original, such as, for example, if you're going to have an amendment regarding free speech, there had to be a power in Congress or something like this. And there is, if you read the document carefully, references where you have an amendment. All of the amendments tie back to the original seven or eight articles of the original Constitution.
Okay.
The Articles of Confederation, on the other hand, allowed for alteration of the Articles of Confederation. In other words, you could completely alter everything in them, so there was nothing left.
Okay.
That's the only reason we were able to legally get an article or a constitution.
So basically what I'm hearing you, what I'm seeing in all this is despite John F. McManus, that's the president that wrote you the letter
right.
of the John Birch Society, despite him calling it a runaway convention, there was no runaway convention. Would that be accurate?
No. They were authorized by Congress as specified by the Articles of Confederation. They did exactly what they were told. The Congress and the state legislatures were fully aware of their activities. They awaited the report. It was sent to Congress. The Congress voted on it, as required by the Articles of Confederation, and sent it on to the states for ratification.
Okay.
And the states ratified it.
And the states then ratified it. At that point, it became the altered Articles of Confederation under a new title, the Constitution, which, under the Articles of Confederation, was perfectly legitimate because they could alter the Articles of Confederation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if we're hearing any negatives about an Article 5 convention from the John Birch Society, we should be very, very concerned about the facts that they're basing it on.
Well,
doesn't
facts,
sound like there's any
facts is a stretch.
Yeah. It sounds like a warped interpretation from what I can tell from what you read.
Yeah, and they've go on, for example, they've spread the rumor that they all have to be, as they refer to it, the same subject. Well, all of the applications are same subject. They're for a convention call. That's, from if you read the language, is what it says. On the applications mm-hmm. of the legislatures, Congress shall call. In other words, the purpose of the application is to force Congress to call.
Mm-hmm.
The issues they bring up then are added at the discretion of the state. Not all of them have issues. Some of them, they just say, well, we'd like to discuss this. Some of them just say, we want a convention, period. It just depends on the state, what it's motivated to present. The Constitution does not specify that it has to be, the application has to be the same subject. But it doesn't have to specify anything as such or same issue. That's a better way to phrase the same issue.
Yeah.
It just simply says there has to be a numeric count, 34 states, in our case right now with 50 states
right.
in the Union, that have to want a convention. That's it. That's the
That's
only requirement.
It. Now, is there anyone else besides the John Birch Society that's against the people calling for a convention?
ACLU.
Really?
You got the extreme left and the extreme right. This is, like I said, this is pure bipartisanship in its perfect form.
I guess.
Yeah, let me read this from Kit Barrett, the Associate Manager, Member Services of the ACLU National Services. This came just July 28th of this year. We asked them to support the Constitution. Now, we all know that the ACLU says that they support the Constitution, that they believe in defending all the rights.
Yeah,
but
so
the
does
simple
the DNC and RNC, but they don't.
Right. But the point is, now, you got to remember, where are they most famous for defending? The First Amendment, right? And
right.
they use the 14th Amendment. So guess what those came from? Article 5. No Article 5, or it isn't obeyed, no amendments. Okay? But this is what she wrote. She said, I would say that the tactics of FOABC and the ACLU appear to differ. The ACLU's mission is to hold the government accountable for breaches in the guarantees provided for in the Constitution and the Bills of Rights. Now remember, Article 5 guarantees an Article 5 convention. It's all
right.
Okay. Creating new amendments would be a focus the ACLU would most likely not pursue. The existing constitutional guarantees have a 200-year history of clarification and interpretation by the courts. New amendments would be starting an entirely new round of court cases in order to establish their legal ramifications. She then continues and says, the ACLU is not generally able to make speculative statements because there is always a need to decide if an issue is within the scope of the mission of the ACLU. To research deeply the legal issues involved, debate amongst the ACLU legal staff on the legal issues, and at times consult other legal experts. At the conclusion of this process, we would decide whether that would be to endorse or take a legal stand against a particular issue. In other words, if it's in the amendments that they politically favor, they're all for it. But if it's the rest of the Constitution, just like the government and the John Birch Society, they expect selective enforcement of the Constitution.
Wow.
Yeah, and she contradicts herself right in their first paragraph. I mean, if they're there to support the current Constitution, then where's the support for Article 5?
Well, I asked her in my reply letter, I said, well, what would be the ACLU's position if you had existed in 1865? Would you have taken the same position on slavery? Or in the 19th Amendment, 1918, women's right to vote? I could keep going on, but I think it's the general gist of my argument.
Yeah, I suppose you didn't get a response.
No.
Yeah.
Like I said, we do get a lot of thundering silence and absolute, what you might call total deer headlights type things from people on this situation. And the more applications we keep finding and posting, the more stares and silence we get.
Wow.
It's interesting to watch.
Interesting, but it's also scary. I mean, you know, so they're choosing to do this on this, but, you know, what's going to happen when they choose to do it on another part of the Constitution?
They do it all the time.
But, you know, I mean...
At least you can take consolence in one thing. I mean, a lot of times people have called the Congress a bunch of crooks. Well, at least thanks to Walker v. members of Congress, now you're accurate.
now we just have to get a judicial branch that'll actually go and arrest them.
Well, you see, now that's the problem. You see, the judicial branch isn't totally naive in this. Not most. Let's say my estimate, and again, you'd have to read the text to be, but my estimate is between 60 to maybe as close as 70% of the applications have their origins in Supreme Court rulings, including setting up in different proposals by the states to want to review Supreme Court rulings so that if the states don't agree, they could vote on or have review by that by people that are directly responsible to the people rather than appointed. And obviously, the court doesn't want to give up that kind of power.
And that's what this all comes down to, is this is relinquishing power.
Which is exactly what Hamilton said back in Federalist 85. The guy knew his business. Yeah, he knew his business.
Hamilton did, yeah. I don't agree with a lot of what he wanted to go with, but you can't deny he was sharp, as were most of the founders.
Yeah, when it comes to the Article 5, he was right on the money. I mean, he basically said, if you don't have this, the people that are in national government will just tend to keep power. And he was right on the money.
Yeah. So, and they have held power tightly.
I mean, this is something that, you know, I guess, it's a huge area that really needs to be focused on. A lot more attention needs to be brought to it. I mean, this could resolve a lot of our issues over time. I mean, it wouldn't be an instant solution, but just getting them to uphold Article 5 would change the ball game. I mean, it would completely change.
I mean, let's just take one example of one proposal from one, just as an example, give some people some ideas. In 1929, I believe, Wisconsin proposed initiative referendum and recall. Now, I've looked at the various applications and done some rough calculations as when, if Congress had obeyed the Constitution. If they had obeyed them when they were applied for and called the conventions at the time they were supposed to do it, about 1963, 64, 65, right in that range, you would have had a convention.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way with a convention sitting there that could have easily had an amendment proposed that says, okay, if you're going to go to war, you have to do it with a written declaration. I don't even think the conservatives or liberals would even debate the issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you'd have had Vietnam.
58,000
Americans would have been alive.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that Richard Nixon would have triggered the series of events that his Watergate triggered, because he'd have been recalled by the vote of the people long before it happened. And he would have been, he wouldn't have been able to just walk away with a pardon. He'd have been recalled, and there's no way that the Ford could have pardoned him. And as a result of that fact that Vietnam might not have occurred, you wouldn't be in the mess today with Iraq and everything, because one of the primary motives was the belief, based on the actions in Vietnam by the terrorists, that we are weak. There wouldn't have been a Vietnam. There wouldn't be the situation today. It all comes in a chain, all because Congress has simply refused to obey the Constitution. And that's just one.
Now, see, and that's part of that ripple effect of history that most people forget to ponder or to consider. You know, what kind of things, what is written in our future history based on the errors of the past?
Right.
And now, those are a lot of very good areas.
Or take bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
You would be able to probably, you would most likely in this situation be able to look at bureaucratic regulations. How many stories have you read over the years of bureaucrats doing whatever to people that they are totally helpless on, totally at the control of these bureaucrats?
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this would, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, this would be a complete game changer. And as I sit here and think, it's just like, I mean, this is like super important. I mean, this is really, really important that people really know about this. And, you know, we talk all the time about talking to our friends and family and all about politics. This is something, this is one of those things that really needs to be discussed. And you know,
where should our listeners send people, Bill?
The website is www.foavc.org. That's our site. And they should also, seriously, just act independently and get a hold of their members of Congress. And if enough people ask, enough people come up in a public meeting and start asking these questions, you know, they aren't going to be able to run.
Yeah, it should be a standard town hall question, I think.
Sure, and beyond that, there's always the dirty trick, shut all the doors and don't let the guy leave.
Yeah, right.
But,
and again, for our listeners, I'll post that letter that you've sent to your congressmen and representatives over at the forums at hearmythunder.org. I'll do that a little bit after we get off the radio here.
And it'll be fun just to see the responses, or lack thereof.
Yeah, well, most of the time the responses we've gotten where our members have actually sent out inquiries to they do one or two things. They either don't respond or they completely sidestep the issue. They will. We've got examples on our site that people can read, but, I mean, it's really ridiculous. I think his name is Senator Cornyn, if memory serves. I believe that's how it's pronounced. Down in Texas, said that.
Yeah,
if
he always sidesteps my questions.
Right. He said if there is an authentic movement, we do something about it. Now it has to be authentic.
What is authentic?
Yeah, what's authentic? I mean, you know, 38 states want a balanced budget. Is that authentic? Well, no, not really.
You know, that doesn't meet the test. Bill, I don't mean to interrupt the flow. I've got Dan Sumars that has been holding for quite some time. Would you mind if we brought him on and
sure.
See? Let me bring him, unmute him. Dan, are you still with us? Well, I see him on there, but maybe not. So if he comes in, he'll join in. This is one thing that I think it will scare people, the idea of having a convention, especially with some of the myths being spread out there. How will it actually affect me, Gary Wood, if a convention is held?
Okay. Most people, if you hear the discussions, want to discuss the issues. A convention is issues. There's no personality. You're not going to have somebody elected that's going to, you know, is going to maintain and stay in as the delegate of conventions. Once the convention's over, they're done. It's 100% issue. You're going to be debating the issue of balanced budget. Should there be, should there not be, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be pure American politics. I mean, think about it. You've got 17 different issues that are going to be. The blogospheres and the debates are just going to explode, and it's all going to be positive because in the ultimate end, these issues that have been floating around are going to be resolved by the American people themselves. It's as participatory as you can get it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point out here real quick that the number one benefit, the number one way that it's going to affect you is that your rights enumerated under the Constitution are going to be honored.
Right.
You will actually have your rights back.
Right.
That,
you get your
being stolen from you at the current moment.
Right. And not only that, but here's the thing. Think of it as a focus group with an attitude. You can, if, let's say, the Congress is doing one particular action, that person points out and says, okay, you have shown that you're doing whatever X consistently. You propose an amendment, gets passed, you shut off the X. You tell them what to do. You're the boss. You're the guy in charge. You're not helpless. You don't need to sit down and start, you know, hoping that you find somebody who can be elected. You take it over and take care of it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way that our system of government is designed. It's not designed to have the president or a member of Congress do it. They don't have the authority. The convention is the way you make changes. It changes the system.
Mm-hmm. Now, the debate going on, these are, again, just to remind everyone, these are delegates that the people select from amongst them to go up. They're not appointed by government officials. They're not government officials themselves. They're not our representatives that are currently sitting in Congress that are going to hold this convention. It's separate, clear, and distinct delegates.
Right, and if they were people that were, as you mentioned, members of the government, under the Constitution, they would have to give up those offices.
Okay, so they can't be current office holders. They're going to
be neighbors. They can't be the United States senator who runs and decides to be a convention delegate on his day off.
Right, and in today's technological world, I would imagine the actual convention itself would more than likely be aired at least on C-SPAN, if not, and like you say, the blogosphere would go crazy. Block Talk Radio would be talking about it every day.
Well, it gets better than that. Because of today's technology, remember, you're talking about issue, okay? So, in other words, it would be, I propose an amendment. You read the amendment. You don't like something, you propose it and give your reasons why, back and forth. You don't need to have a physical convention. The entire convention could, if the states and everybody wanted to do it, be held online. You do not have to have a physical convention because all you're doing is exchanging information about issues. As far as voting and so on and so forth, arrangements could be made. I've personally talked to people in the computer world that know, that are a lot smarter than me about computers. I mean, basically, I know where the keyboard is. And they have said without exception, oh, yeah, we could come up with ways that would be totally secure for a group of delegates to vote and conduct elections and so on and so forth and make motions in live time and so on and so forth that would be secure and conduct a business. And you would then, therefore, be able to, for example, people want to propose an amendment. You set up a page. You'd have to make it where, of course, it couldn't be spammed and the usual things that everybody knows about and does anyway. And they would be able to type up the proposed language and actually submit it to the delegates for them to consider. Now, that's about as participatory as you can get.
Yeah.
Now each issue, each convention, the delegates are new, right? Not the same delegates debating issue after issue after issue, convention after convention. Each convention is a fresh bunch of people, right?
Right. There would be in other words, once this convention was held, all of these applications that are sitting there, this is why they would deal with them, because they would then, quote-unquote, discharge them. They would have been resolved. So you would go back to a zero count of applying states. So the next time there would be a convention, be it the next year or 100 years, you would start all over again. So the issues would be completely fresh, and so would the people.
This first one, then, would be, as you called it earlier, a general convention, and that's how we'd actually deal with all the hundreds of applications that have been put forth so far and ignored by Congress.
Right, and the reason that it's a general convention is not because that is anything that is the fault of the states, it's the fault of Congress. They just haven't dealt with anything, and this stuff is piled up and piled up and piled up. So it's the responsibility of Congress that there would be a quote-unquote general convention, not the fact that there is a general convention that they can do anything. It's the responsibility of Congress by their inaction.
Right.
And another benefit of this would be that the states would actually have their power restored that has been stolen from them.
Yes,
they would have power again.
And this would balance it back.
You would see an enormous flood of applications. And that would help to restore our Federalist Republic just simply by them acknowledging this and the states getting their power back.
Well, what I liken it to is that you would have a situation where the people would be given a new set of tools. A smart convention would not try to solve every issue that's on that presentation.
Oh, Lord, I hope not.
No, what they try to do is they'd look for commonalities, and they would provide tools whereby all of these problems that have been brought up by people asking for these issues to be resolved could be resolved by the people themselves. Hence, for example, Wisconsin's suggestion, initiative referendum recall, the states asking for what they call a court of the union to deal with so many Supreme Court rulings that nobody agrees with, so on and so forth. New set of tools.
So why don't the states just go ahead and hold a convention on their own without Congress calling the convention? Why don't they just go ahead and gather and hold their own convention? Why does Congress have to call the convention? Why don't they just go ahead and hold one?
Well, primarily my answer would be because Article 5 says they can't. Congress has to call. And you couldn't justify saying that a convention is a legal convention.
Yeah, it wouldn't be legal.
It wouldn't be legal or constitutional.
But they could get a lot of attention.
Right. But the point is, all gather together
and say, hey, we're holding a convention.
Right. But the point is that it's kind of hard to argue to Congress that they need to obey the Constitution when you yourself aren't doing it.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's very true.
So that is probably the main reason.
It would be more productive for them to all get together and propose it to the media saying, hey, why aren't we being heard? I mean, that would be the productive thing. We've all called for this convention, and they're not doing it. Help us out.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the most productive thing.
What's gone on with Supreme Court rulings and things in the past that have been made regarding amendment processes?
The Supreme Court had four Supreme Court rulings that basically emphatically stated that Congress must call. They then issued an advisory opinion in 1939 called Coleman that said that they have nothing to do with the process. Fine. And then they had my decision where basically the court said, under the political question doctrine, Congress can veto the Constitution.
Under the political?
Yeah.
See,
they said what they did in my lawsuit was they said, first, I didn't have standing, which should have meant nothing else happened. They should have stopped right there. No ruling. If I don't have standing, by the rules of standing, they don't have authority to make a ruling. Then they turned around and said, well, under the political question doctrine, Congress has the right to do things. So, in other words, basically, they said, I don't have standing, then made a ruling anyway. And let's get this clear on something. When I say this went to the Supreme Court, a lot of people says, well, it didn't go for cert. The court didn't hear it. That's incorrect.
Right.
When the Supreme Court is submitted, if they don't act, they are simply affirming the lower court's ruling. They acted. They just simply decided they didn't want to write anything about it. They accepted the idea that under the political question doctrine, that this is fine. And if there's any question further about it, in the lawsuit, this was brought out at the Supreme Court level and by federal law. There's a lot of people don't realize the Supreme Court rules are indeed federal law. By federal law, the United States, which it couldn't do, which it could avoid before at the Supreme Court level, had to actually say, was my statement that they could veto the Constitution correct, true, and correct as to fact and law? The Solicitor General said it was. It's now an official statement of the United States government. It's not my opinion anymore. The moment he sent that out and did what he called waived his right of response, it became an official statement of the United States government to the attorney of record representing the Congress, who apparently told him to say that. Don't ask me why. I've never figured it out. but that's what the federal laws say.
So is there any further legal action that you're taking to try to move this along and make it happen? Or, I mean, have you done all that you can do?
Yeah, from the lawsuit angle, I pretty well got what I wanted out of it. I was hoping that they would call a convention. But what I did was, I got them to be on public record. See,
yeah.
Up until then, the reason they got away with it is they were not on public record. Now
yeah,
they
just ignored it.
Yeah, they ignored it and got away with it because as long as they didn't do anything, they were fine. But when they came to a lawsuit, that's when they crossed the line. When they had to say, well, we're not going to obey the Constitution, that's a direct violation of the oath of office. The language used is mental reservations. Obviously, they have a mental reservation. They're not obeying the Constitution. That makes it a criminal violation.
So now the only thing that really can be done is for the people to stand up and demand their rights.
Fundamentally, yes. And like I said, the fun part is doing that, is watching them run. And I mean, they literally, like I said in that letter, they will run.
Oh, I'm going to use your letter. I'm going to have a lot of fun with this, believe me.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to have a kick,
get up to one of these guys that's running for Congress, that's in Congress, you know, get up real close to them, and right in the middle of the speech, go, Article 5, and watch what happens. They'll freak. It's just, you know, it doesn't matter whether you support it or not. It's just cool because, you know, they're all going to jump because they know that they've now committed a crime and they're trying to keep the people from finding out about it. Well, that's what normal crooks do, so what's the surprise?
This is just amazing to me, though. It's just, yeah, I guess I shouldn't be amazed, but it still is amazing to me that they can do this and just continually get away with it, and there's nothing going to happen to them.
Well, actually, if the people stand up and insist on a convention, a lot of things could happen to them. A lot of them.
Yeah, at that point.
As people find out about it. I mean, forget the Article 5 question as such. Do you really want a bunch of people in Congress whose judgment is so bad that they don't even realize that they're committing a crime by saying they don't have to obey the Constitution? Is that the kind
of
people you want in judgment?
I don't want anybody in Congress that's not willing to uphold their oath of office, plain and simple.
Yeah.
That's my number one judgment on any representative is, are you going to uphold your oath of office? And
which is you're going to do what the Constitution says. Yeah,
yeah,
and that's
they
part
don't
of
have
what,
a clue what that's about. They just
right.
don't have
and,
a clue.
They're to the point of arrogance, to be blunt, that they don't even feel they have to worry about even making it a public record. I mean, this is all public record. This is not like some blogosphere or something. This is United States federal court records. I've got them all on the website. But, I mean, if somebody wanted to check it, they're down at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they're at the Supreme Court, and so on and so forth. They're there for examination. They don't have to go to our website. They think we faked it out. Just go to the various courts and dig out the records.
Right. And you'll find out for yourselves that this is on public record. And that is such a service. And, you know, that's some of that quiet, rebellious, wonderful efforts going on by patriots across the country. And, Bill, I want to personally thank you. That was not an easy task you did, as you well know. How many pages was your first?
It was 800 pages and took me about 5 years to write. The ironic thing about this, though, and I do have to let everybody know about this, is I've said many times there's a destiny in this. To give you an idea about these cases, I'm, first of all, not an attorney. I researched them, but I always felt when I was writing this, I never actually was writing it as such. I would go, for example, there would be a case that, or a particular point that I needed to make in the lawsuit, and up would show an opponent who would write an email, and I'd never hear from him again. There'd be what I needed. I'd go to the Internet, and I would go to Find Law, which used to be a case place that you could get all the Supreme Court rulings. And it got to the point that I literally would just pick a year, start clicking, and by about the third decision, it found exactly what I needed. There has been such a chain of people in exactly the right order that I couldn't list all the people who have helped out on this situation. But as FOAVC and the movements before it needed it, it's been an exact order as needed when needed. It's an amazing chain to watch this thing go. And every single time that something was needed, there somebody showed up.
Oh,
almost on cue.
See, that's that. If you believe out there in the power of intention, there it is in action.
Yeah, it's the only way to phrase it, because you coincidence is one time, but I mean, when it happens over and over again, you begin to realize that there's something going on here. I would not want to go speculate exactly what I would call it, but it's definitely proceeding in a very unique manner, a very unique situation. The word is getting out. People are finding out about this. They're going to keep spreading, and the situation is such that I'm sure it's going to continue to spread.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I really like about the challenges we're about to all face. Not the pain and the agony and everything that we're going to go through, but the fact that it is causing, in my estimation, an awakening around this country and around the globe of really what did we have, what have we lost, how can we get it back?
Yeah,
because more and more people are realizing we are way off course.
Right, and the thing is that a convention can allow us to get back on that course. By its very existence, it will create the federalist system, and it certainly can resolve a lot of the problems and issues that have caused us to deviate and move off of what was intended by the founders, or where the government is just simply not doing what it was intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's actually probably the easiest way to limit the power that the three branches of government have and are abusing. And this is the single most easiest way to just instantly limit that power, just cut it straight in half.
Right, and it's also, and this is important, it's not election bound. You get an amendment in place, it stays in place until, of course, it's repealed. Now, that's something else a lot of people have to understand.
Nice.
They say, well, you know, these guys are going to do X or Y as delegates. Well, even if they did, Congress could propose an amendment to back it right back down again. The states can recall and put a new convention in place. So, you know, even if these people did, you just hold another convention, put a different amendment in, repeal the old whatever they did, and move on.
Press forward. We're down to, believe it or not, quickly, and this show went entirely too quickly. I'd like to extend an invitation for a future show if you'd like to come back, for sure.
I'd like to do that.
Because it sounds like we've just barely scratched the surface. But in our last minute or so here, about 2 minutes, what kind of final thought do you want to leave the listeners, Bill,
now? If you have an Article 5 convention, you can see that you'll have a completely different kind of nation. The people will again know that they are sovereign American citizens. They will not feel helpless. If they want change, they can accomplish it. They don't have to hope somebody gets elected or look for this to happen or listen to a bunch of politicians who never obey or do what they say they're going to do in an election. They can just go out and do it. They can go out and propose an amendment. They can work directly with their own people, and they can actually cause it to occur. It's a different kind of an America. It used to exist in this nation. It's been covered up by a lot of special interests and political groups for their own political ends, and people have been lulled into forgetting the power of their own government. And what they forget is the design of the Constitution was that they were supposed to be the leading element in this entire system of government, not the Supreme Court, not the President, or not even the Congress. It is
right.
The sovereign American people. They are supposed to hold the power, and that means, you know, you don't just let everybody else push you around. You make the decisions.
Absolute. We have the host of Founding Truth, Loki, in our chat room, and he would like to also invite you on his show. Would you mind if I shared his email with him?
You've got my email address.
I've got your email address, and Loki, if you can shoot me a message, or one way or another, we'll get you Bill's contact information. And again, we'd like to have you back on as well. Let's see, we got 50 seconds left. Jason, anything in the last couple of seconds?
I want to, again, thank Bill for sharing his time here with us, and thank you so, so much for everything that you've done concerning the Article 5. I mean, invaluable contribution of time and effort that you put into this, and I hope that something actually comes out of it and we finally do get an Article 5 convention, and I know we will be pressing this, and this will be something that we continually mention and talk about now, and thank
yep.
you for educating us on it. And
I appreciate the time to give me a chance to do it.
Thank you,
yeah.
Bill. I'll get you and Loki together. Mike in the chat room says we need more patriots like you, Bill, and I agree. Everybody, thank you very much, and we are not streaming, but we are recording. so the live stream just ended. But we are recording as we speak, so anyone that listens to the archive will hear what we're saying right now. Bill, I sure appreciate it. I feel like we've just scratched the surface, but what a wealth of information.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll talk to you later, and appreciated the interview.
All right, Bill.
We'll see
thank
you later.
You very much.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye.
Good night.